This program is a production of the Reformed Forum, online at reformedforum.org. This is Christ the Center, episode number 60. Today we speak with T. David Gordon about his new book, Why Johnny Can't Preach. Welcome to Christ the Center, Doctrine for Life, a weekly conversation of Reformed theology. My name is Camden Busey, and I have with me today Jeff Waddington, who is teacher of the congregation at Calvary OPC in Ringgoes, New Jersey. How are you doing, Jeff?
I am doing fine here, buried under about 6 or 7 inches of snow in Philadelphia.
I was actually able to, I'm with Jeff at his house now and had to actually trek through, I don't know. It's a significant amount of snow, and your landlord doesn't seem to like to shovel. So
I'll leave that one alone.
We also have Nick Batzig, who I'm assuming is not in any snow. He's a church planter in Richmond Hill, Georgia. How are you doing, Nick?
I'm doing good, Camden. I thought I might go out and get a tan today. It's nice
down here. All right.
Well, anyway, and we also have Jim Cassidy, who's the pastor at Jeff's church, Calvary OPC in Ringgoes. How are you doing today, Jim? It's good to have you.
Good to be here, Camden. We have a little bit less snow than that, and although you shouldn't assume too much, I understand Atlanta, Georgia.
I did hear that, yeah.
Yeah.
They got a little bit, which really perplexed me, but I guess it does snow down there. Well, we're very pleased to have our guest today is Dr. T. David Gordon, who's professor of religion and Greek at Grove City College. We're very pleased to have you on, Dr. Gordon.
Thanks. Good to be here. We don't have any snow. We did have single digits this morning, but no snow.
Actually, I'd probably rather have the snow than the single digits, but
it's pretty brisk.
We're very excited to talk today about Dr. Gordon's new book entitled Why Johnny Can't Preach. And as we were getting started, Jeff, he was very quick to add that he's glad his name isn't Johnny. But we're pleased to have Dr. Gordon on to talk about media ecology, those sorts of topics, and how they relate to preaching and basically the understanding of preaching as well. But first, we wanted to stop and talk about any new books. Jeff, is there anything to mention?
Well, before I get to the book, there's just, a very brief little story. Dr. Gordon used to pastor a PCA congregation in Nashua, New Hampshire, and I believe he came into town just about the time that I was leaving Nashua. But a few years after that, well now 12 years ago, he was moderator of what was then the Northeast Presbytery of the PCA, and we were having a meeting in Schenectady, New York, and I was brought under care. And Dr. Gordon was doing his duties, I guess, issuing a charge to me before the men of the presbytery and the visitors. And he says to me, "Jeff, I understand that in a few days you'll be moving down to Philadelphia to begin your studies at Westminster Seminary." And so he then says, "You know, it's a challenging school. It's an enjoyable school, but it's a challenging school." And then he looks at me and says, "And you know, Jeff, when I started, I was your size." And I had a laugh at the expense of Dr. Gordon. The whole place broke up in laughter. You have to understand that I'm big, tall, and wide, and Dr. Gordon is narrow and short.
Right. At my size, you have to run around in the shower in the morning to get wet.
Oh.
But one thing I will tell you is that you had a wonderful way to keep the Presbytery business moving along. Whenever there was a stall or maybe a stress point, as anybody that knows you have a good dry sense of humor. You were able to make a comment that would break the tension or break the log jam, if you will, and keep the meeting moving along. And I was very impressed with that.
Oh, good. Thanks.
So that's my story. And of course, I've been reading as much as I can when I come across your material. We've been very, very appreciative of that. Now, the one book that I wanted to mention, and there isn't a lot of new material from our last recording, is a book coming out in April by Crossway entitled Precious Blood, The Atoning Work of Christ. And it's edited by Rick Phillips, and it's based on the Philadelphia Conference on Reformed Theology. And I believe contributors include R.C. Sproul, Phil Ryken, Joel Beakey, Derek Thomas, Carl Truman, and Bob Godfrey. And it's edited by our good friend Rick Phillips.
And
yes, go ahead, Nick.
I was just going to tell you, Rick, you know, Rick is the head of the PCRT now. I don't know what his official title is, but he told me that they are going to be doing all the conferences. They're going to be converting them into books, the conference
very good.
Talks. So I think this is maybe the first or the second installation in what is going to be a long series. And I think they're great lectures. I mean, I had a guy once tell me he didn't go to PCRT because he didn't get much out of it. Every time I listen to those lectures, I get something out of them. So I think that's going to be a nice publication.
No, I agree. Well, that's it for new books, Camden.
Excellent. Well,
I should mention one other item, and that is for our readers who may be interested in the new issue of The Ordained Servant.
Oh, yeah.
The March 2009 issue that's dealing with the issue of union with Christ and the debates and discussions that are going on within our circles on that topic. And I would encourage our listeners to look that up.
Excellent. That is an excellent issue. I've read some of the articles in there, and we posted some links to them on the websites. There's some really good stuff in there. Dr. Gaffin has a review of Michael Horton's Covenant and Salvation. There's also a response to John Fesco's criticisms of Gaffin's views. And regardless of which side of the, quote, debate you might be on, it's a very illuminating volume. So I'd pick that up or read it online if you can. Well, I suppose we'll get started here. We're interested to speak about this new book from Presbyterian and Reformed Publishers titled Why Johnny Can't Preach. It's a treatment of the ideas of media ecology as they relate to preaching. And it's a shorter little book, just a little over about 100 pages, and it has five chapters. It starts off, and as we might gather from the very title, it presupposes that preaching today is fairly weak and poor. I guess as we can start today, what do you think some of the causes, Dr. Gordon, are of the relative state and weakness of preaching today?
Yeah, well, you know, most of you guys may be too young to understand the title for that purpose. You know, in 1966, a book came out, Why Johnny Can't Read and What You Can Do About It. And then in 1990, another volume, Why Johnny Can't Write, How to Improve Writing Skills. So I borrowed my title deliberately from those two, Why Johnny Can't Read and Why Johnny Can't Write. And they actually introduced much of what I'm suggesting, which is this is the logical corollary 20-some-odd years later. That is to say, because Johnny doesn't read the way he once did and because he doesn't write the way he once did, he obviously can't preach. And so it's media ecological because the broader theme I'm wrestling with is how the dominance of image-based and electronic media after World War II have altered the sensibilities of the average American compared to a typographic culture. And regrettably, those changes are all to the negative as regards the capacity to preach.
Right. Christianity really at its core is a written – I mean, we've been given a book. We weren't given a movie.
Right.
And at core, it is a textual religion, so to speak, if we want to call it that. Now, some of our listeners might be familiar with the works of Neil Postman, and we've also had Greg Reynolds on before to speak about a similar issue. Are you on board with their theses and their views?
Well, Postman's one of his books is one of the required texts in my media ecology course here, and then two or three others of his books are recommended. And then I was Greg's external reader when he wrote that book as his doctoral thesis out at Escondido, and have had him guest lecture in the course. So Greg and I are old conversation partners on the questions of preaching in electronic cultures. And yeah, I'm probably more Postmanian than McLuhan. You know, the difference between Postman and his mentor McLuhan, mm-hmm. is that Marshall McLuhan thought that media ecology was merely a descriptive discipline. We're just talking about how cultures changed. But Postman always said, well, we start there, but ultimately we have to be prescriptive and proscriptive, that some of those changes are more humane and some of those changes are less humane. And so Postman was much more willing to be prescriptive and proscriptive in his writings than Marshall McLuhan was. Marshall McLuhan was really more of a fatalist. This is just what's happening. Hmm. And you just hang on.
The Postman is more interested also in saying that media are not neutral. They actually have an effect on how we learn, how we understand, and they actually change things.
Yeah, well, and he did get that from McLuhan. McLuhan's famous aphorism, the medium is,
right.
Basically teaches that. That, for instance, even for McLuhan, a culture that watches television totally apart from content is simply a different culture than a culture that reads books. It doesn't matter what content you pour into those books or what content you pour into the television. Even he recognized that the historical effect of a medium was far more important than the message that was contained therein.
Mm-hmm. So it would make sense that if Johnny doesn't know how to read or write, or he's not interested in those things, he's not good at them, that it would impact his ability to communicate a written message in a verbal medium.
Yeah, that's right. So what happens is after an initial chapter in which I basically try to make the case that's Johnny can't preach, because not everyone today would be happy with that. So I do a little brief chapter indicating the lines of evidence that have brought me to that conclusion. But then I have a chapter, Why Johnny Can't Preach Part 1, which is that Johnny can't read texts, and then Why Johnny Can't Preach Part 2, Johnny can't write. And I wrestle a lot with the reading of texts. Literary people and cultural observers talk about reading texts as a special kind of reading. It's when we read something not merely for what is said, but for how it is said.
Hmm.
And so Alan Bloom has written essays on this. Walter Benjamin has written essays on this. A number of people have written about reading a text. So, for instance, you could read a simple sentence, "It's nice to have friends," and that's a very different thing than Shakespeare's 29th sonnet, where you have 14 lines discussing, what a relief and pleasure it is, even in a difficult moment in life, to have a true friend. And so those who are willing to read texts are very different from those who scan books for information. And if you recall the study done by the National Endowment for Humanities in 2003-2004 on a-literacy, that people who can read don't. One of the more important findings was not only is reading down, but literary reading is way down. That fewer people read today than ever before in our culture. Of those who read, a very small percent read literature, and of those who read literature, an even smaller percentage read verse. So they might read the occasional short story in the New Yorker, and they might even read a Cormac McCarthy novel, but they're not reading Shakespearean sonnets. They're not reading Robert Frost.
Mm-hmm.
And yet, poetry reading is an extremely significant thing for ministers, I argue with the book.
Dr. Gordon, I was wondering if I could jump ahead to a practical question. Normally, sure. We would ask a lot of – go through the theological aspects of books, but I was reading this week, my friend James Grant had a post over at In Light of the Gospel where he was talking about how to introduce hymnody and psalmody into congregations that have neglected that, and he had some pretty insightful thoughts about doing it very slowly and with systematically. I wonder, what advice do you have for ministers who maybe are in congregations where textual preaching has not been emphasized, the things that we would hold dear to us? Do you have any practical advice at the outset for men that are in congregations that have not had the rich heritage that maybe some of us have seen in our own churches?
Well, Well, first, if I can, I'm delighted to hear that your friend is talking about introducing psalms and hymns to churches. I've already written the sequel to this, haven't sent it to the publisher yet, and the sequel is Why Johnny Can't Sing Hymns. And trying to deal with the cultural forces which have brought us to the present situation where people feel that anything that's not contemporary is foreign to them and non-musical. So I'm delighted to hear others are addressing this. But, yeah, I mean, I think what happens is to introduce expository preaching, one of the things you have to do is combine your ministerial discipline with ministerial self-discipline. In your study, you're chasing down every potentially significant exegetical matter that helps you understand the passage. But in the same study, you have to throw 70% of that in the trash can. Because once you have found the three or two primary reasons for taking text a certain way, you have to throw all the rest of it out. Because people only need to listen to your expositional argument to the point that they're satisfied that it's a valid and germane argument. And there might be 12 lines of argument, but only two or three of which are powerful enough to make the case, and the other nine are supporting. And so one of the challenges is to distinguish a true expository sermon from an expository lecture. They cannot be the same. You have to throw out of the sermon all sorts of other less significant things so that the sermon does not become tedious. But once you do that, you can preach expositorily and people very quickly adjust. My old colleague Gordon Conwell, Doug Stewart, often served as an interim minister throughout New England before he had his own church. And after the first couple of weeks, you know, people would nod politely at the door. And after five or six, they'd say, Dr. Stewart, we really like the changes you've made to preaching. We can really follow you now. And, of course, he hadn't made any changes. Doug's an old expositor, and that's all he's going to do. What happened is they learned to listen to him.
Oh, wow.
Yeah, that's great.
And so I think as long as you're willing to throw out the stuff that doesn't need to be there, that your exposition serves the kerygma and not the other way around, and the kerygma is not done through exposition alone, if you get that the sermon still has to preach and not be a lecture, then you'll throw out the stuff that isn't necessary. You might have one or two smart cookies afterwards ask you, did you consider X? And you say, yes, I did. I didn't include it in the sermon, but I've got notes on it in my study. You're welcome to them.
I think it's Vern Poitras who's said before, I might be mistaken, but he says you need to bring the bread to the service, not the bread factory.
That's what he told us when I was there in the 70s.
Yeah. Yes. And that's a very wise statement. And me as a young, you know, aspiring preacher, it's very, you want to show that you've done the work and you want to make sure that you, you know, cross your T's and dot your I's, but you can't burden the people and just sit there and lecture. You don't want to preach simply about the text, you need to preach from it.
Yeah, I think that's right. And I think that it's not that difficult if you're self-conscious of the issue to say that at the most people want to be persuaded that the point of your sermon is justly based upon that passage. And so we give them enough to demonstrate that. And in some sermons it takes more because the common understanding of a passage in our culture is so often wrong. And so in some cases, you have to do a little bit more because you know that the average person picking up and reading that is expecting you to do a different thing with it. And so in those, you have to do a little bit more, and you have to say something like, now, on first blush, this passage might very well appear to be saying X, but I want to give you two reasons for why a number of responsible commentators since Calvin have taken it otherwise. And you have to just make the case. I preached, for instance, on the temptation narrative 2 weeks ago at a church here. And I know that what everyone does with it is do some moralistic thing on how to avoid temptation. And so I know mm-hmm. that everyone's expecting the sermon to go in that direction. So I had to actually give them five reasons within the passage to demonstrate that Matthew was trying to demonstrate that this was a distinctive and unique temptation and not a common temptation.
Right.
And that took 5 or 6 minutes. But I think they were persuaded by the end, and they could realize, oh, no, this is Christology. This isn't practical help. And it is Christology. It's deep Christology. And when James Henley Thoreau preached on it, the title of his sermon was Christ Tempted as the Last Adam.
That's right.
And Thornwell was right, and that is what Matthew was doing. He was doing Christology. And so I had to make a little bit of more exposition in that sermon than I might wish to and others because I knew I had to fight uphill against a common misunderstanding of it.
Dr. Gordon, I'd like to follow up with another practical question. There doesn't seem to be much instruction for men as to what books to preach through in expository preaching, the order you choose them. I mean, I know there's a lot of factors. You have to know your congregation. But I guess, you know, for me, I'm not going to preach through Job anytime soon because I don't want to lose entire congregation. And I know it's God's word and I know it's valuable and I need to read it and digest it, but Job is not going to be the first book I preach through at this church plant. Do you have any thoughts for pastors about a systematic way of choosing books to preach through, doctrinal narrative, any kind of thoughts you have on that?
Not a whole lot. I mean, what I would have to say is just sort of standard stuff on that, which is that, you know, make sure you're covering all the different genres. You want to preach some Old Testament narratives, some New Testament narratives, some prophetic stuff, some gospel stuff, some epistles, and this kind of a thing. And Doug Stewart's advice was always to try to preach brief enough series that for those who just never really connected to it, they weren't stuck there for 5 years. That's why I say, you know, in my opinion, Martin Lloyd-Jones is probably the worst preacher ever to have preached. I, you know, take the Minority Report on that one. Because he never did preach the Word of God. He just preached the words of God. He would preach an entire sermon on a phrase or a clause here and there. And it must have been insufferable to go through 6 or 7 years to get through Ephesians or something. I think it's much better to choose briefer series and to get through them and preach large units, preach more natural literary units.
Hey, Dr. Gordon, just a question, kind of shifting gears here a little bit. If I've come across some connections, I think just in reading stuff like Greg Reynolds' work and some of the stuff that you've put out and others have put out, a connection between, I don't know if this is just making it up or what, but a connection between what we see in modern day and so much of modern day American evangelical Christianity and really what was happening in terms of teaching and preaching ministry back in the medieval days before the Reformation. It seems as if in the medieval church, much was given to the visual, to icons, to pictures. It was told these people are literate, therefore the only way that they can understand the gospel is through pictures. And statues. It seems as if a similar, although jazzed up, technologically savvy mentality is in Protestant churches today, where again we're going back to the picture. You have PowerPoints during the sermon, film clips being showed, and the rationale is that this is a visual culture we live in, therefore we have to reach people with pictures and where they're at and the half hour television program and all this. Any thoughts on that connection?
Marshall McLuhan, when someone referred to the belief that it's the content, not the medium that's important. He referred to that belief as, quote, the numb stance of a technological idiot, end quote. And he meant idiot in the old Greek sense because idiotes is one's own. And he called it that because, you know, people familiar with their own culturally dominant medium just think that the medium's neutral. But they aren't. And one of the interesting thing about the fad chasers whenever there's a new medium is they think that that's just the way it's always been. They are actually breathtakingly naive that people like Socrates objected to writing, for instance. They're not even aware of it. They're not aware that for 3 centuries prior to the New Testament, the Greeks debated whether drama was an appropriate form to use to promote religion or ethics. And some said yes, and some said no. So that when Paul says, God has chosen, eudokeson, God has chosen through the folly of preaching to save those who believe. Paul knew perfectly well that the question of what media are proper to communicate religion had been debated for centuries in his culture. The remarkable thing, in other words, is that they were very sophisticated students of media ecology, and here, loaded with new media, we are utter idiots. We are completely naive about the relation between medium and message.
How would you relate Romans 10 to this topic. And the argument that Paul makes is that faith comes by hearing and hearing by the word of God. Do you find that inherently a media ecological category?
Oh, yeah. I think that proclamation is the issue. Mm-hmm. You know, you mentioned Greg Reynolds earlier. He was much influenced, as I am, by the work of the late Walter Ong, who taught at St. Louis University for many, many years, a Jesuit, and then later a Roman Catholic priest on top of that. And in Ong's early career, he actually thought that oral language was in some measure, in some ways, superior to written language, almost embraced Socrates' view. Now, the later Walter Ong came to a more nuanced position and came to recognize that that typography and that the written word cultivated a remarkable kind of rationality and intelligence. But he retained his appreciation for the spoken word, that there is something there that you don't get in other ways. And yeah, I think that it is a medium that God has approved. And frankly, I think we could live without the printing press if we had to, as church, and we wouldn't suffer much. But we could not do without preaching.
Mm. Dr. Gordon, I'm wondering what your thoughts are for our listeners concerning the use of media illustrations in preaching. I know the cultural relevance discussion is kind of, you know, all pervasive, even in the reform camp right now. And, you know, I've found men like Sinclair Ferguson who very judiciously use things like commercials or maybe something like the Beatles. Carl Truman will use Led Zeppelin in illustrations. What are your thoughts about a right way, a helpful way, or wrong ways, and maybe avoiding the use or the overuse of pop culture and media in illustrations and sermons? Do you have any thoughts for us?
Well, I guess two. One is, you know, verbal illustrations are very old in the English language. I think I recall Plato saying something about a cave, for instance. And yet he didn't draw a picture of a cave, and he didn't need to draw a picture about a cave. I think that the God who incarnated as the Word made flesh is pretty clever about language and its capacities and is fairly confident in what we can do with it. So I'm not persuaded that we need to supplement language with visual images. Verbal images is a part of language and quite useful in some occasions. So the first is, I don't think that it's spiritually or psychologically true that that those images, verbal images, help us much. They've proven, for instance, neurologically, that the brain is much less active looking at an image than it is following language. Because what happens when you're reading a novel, and Cormac McCarthy, for instance, paints a picture of a landscape using words, your mind actually has to be a co-creator with McCarthy. Your mind actually has to take his language and create that scene.
Huh.
And so neurologically, it is simply proven that language, descriptive language, is more neurologically involving than looking at a picture of the same. Mm-hmm. And so what happens is, if you're going to use illustrations, and I'm not a big fan of them, but if you're going to use the illustrations, I think verbal illustrations are more than adequate to the task. Jesus got along fine with them. And even Nathan the prophet told a wonderful little parable to King David, and it was all that he needed to bring judgment upon him. So I think if Nathan only needs a little story about a man who has a few sheep and another who has a lot, then we don't really need to think that we have to have screens up front. Hmm. But I also, by the way, don't think sermons need to be illustrated ordinarily. That's a very minority report.
Can you explain that for us, Dr. Gordon? Because I'm fascinated by that.
I think that we don't want to suggest that we're Gnostics or a mystery religion. Even though our religion certainly has mystery, it has wonderful mysteries in it. Certainly the Trinity is, the two natures of Christ, these kinds of things. But many of the things that are matters of our faith are not mysterious. And to, as I would call it, over-illustrate them, that suggests that the problem is in some sense that people haven't caught on to some secret that will open up and unlock the Christian life. The problem of the Christian life for Gordon is Gordon's intractably sinful heart. That's the problem. And we flatter people to give them this conceit that if they just had the right special little insight, everything would go into place for them. They'd still have an intractably sinful heart to deal with. And so if a friend of mine invites me to his house to help hang sheetrock, if he's adding a room to the house, and I say, are we going to frame the wall horizontally or vertically. And he looks at me and says, well, there was a little girl who had a bunny. Well, I think the guy's off his rocker at that point. Just tell me, like, vertical or horizontal, right? So I think what's happened is for many people who really have no interest in the Christian religion, they are interested in amusing lecture or a talk, and so they say that they like illustrations and so forth. But I would say that we should only illustrate those things that need to be illustrated. If religious discourse is illustrated more than non-religious discourse, it suggests implicitly a kind of mystery religion approach.
Interesting. Well, that's an interesting...
Our religion is just straightforward.
Yeah.
Christ died for our sins according to the scriptures, and he was raised for our justification.
Do you find different approaches... even in the New Testament, and you were also very adept at New Testament studies, just going along this thread, do you find any differences in the approach to the different apostles and Jesus as they relayed the message? Jesus used parables oftentimes, and there's certain reasons why he did that. But Paul was often very direct. I'm thinking of Acts 17 and others where he just proclaimed it straight out. Peter as well in Acts 2. Do you find different approaches among them? Do you think that's personal, or do you think that there's a reason behind those?
None of them illustrates much. The only illustration in Galatians, I suppose, is the one about Sarah and Hagar, isn't it?
Yeah, the allegory.
Mm-hmm. And yeah, so there's just that one figure of speech, and it comes at the end of the discourse after he's already made the sub-arguments of chapter 3 and 4. So chapter 4, 21 through 31, I suppose it is... is an illustration that comes at the end to sort of make the point poignantly clear. But I don't think it's there to make it intellectually clear. I think the point is to say to the Galatian errorists, right, you're going to get cast out the way the slave woman and her son were cast out.
Mm-hmm.
So I think that there's also more of a rhetorical point.
Do you think that the parables were you?
Oh, yeah. I'm teaching a course on parables now, and I teach parable speech is judgment speech.
Jesus. Yeah, exactly. Just like tongues, Dr. Geffen makes that case.
Absolutely.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, I mean, look at the first parable any of us remembers in the Old Testament. It's the one I just mentioned. Nathan tells a little story to David about a man who had one sheep and another who had hundreds, because David had a lot of concubines. And the man with hundreds of sheep, you know, wanted the one from the man who only had one.
Right.
And so, you know, David kind of gets angry at this. What a horrible man to do such a thing. And Nathan reaches up his bony prophetic finger and says, you're the man. So parable speech biblically is ordinarily judgment speech.
Mm-hmm.
As Matthew 13 and Mark 4 say, to fulfill Isaiah 6, that you may see and never perceive, hear and never understand, lest you see with your eyes, hear with your ears, turn with your heart, and I heal you. Jesus' speech parables were told for about the opposite reason most people think.
Right.
He told it was what we now call coded speech, the way Negro spirituals were coded. They could sing about Sweet Chariot, And their masters thought they were singing about crossing into heaven, and they were talking about coming up here through Pittsburgh and crossing into Canada. Deep River is that way, and many others. It's the kind of coded language where if you don't understand the code, you're completely flummoxed as to what's happening. And Jesus' own disciples, apart from his explanations, did not ordinarily understand what he was talking about. So, we wouldn't want to use Jesus as an example of
it. Sure, because... It's different by nature of what he was doing and at what redemptive time he was doing it, too.
That's right.
I have a question. If a pastor or minister is now understands this, the problem we're facing, and I this was driven home to me recently. I was talking with family, and they brought up the necessity of using illustrations in sermons, and they talked about the parables. And I said, do you know the purpose for the parable? And I outlined that Jesus tells us, following especially the parable of the sower, right?
Right.
Pointing back to Isaiah 6. And the answer that I got was, oh, you're just intellectual. And so what I'm after is I'm thinking that a minister who's committed to learning to preach properly, and I think this is probably a lifelong discipline.
Yeah.
What is the kind of tough skin that we have to develop, because we may not be facing congregations that want to hear what we believe need to be taught, or do not want to hear in the way that we believe need to be taught, because you're saying Johnny can't preach, but the truth of the matter is also Johnny can't listen.
And yeah, the congregation can't understand preaching.
So we want to be pastoral, and this we've already mentioned that we want to be to do this gently and slowly, but it still needs to be done, and that means there's going to be, I expect that there will be resistance. Do you have any words of wisdom on that?
Well, you know, you might get some resistance, but I think you'd get less than you think. Lig Duncan was in town a couple of weeks ago to do some guest lectures and guest preaching here at the college. And at our regular chapel in the mornings, they limit you to like 17 minutes. You know, Lig can hardly get started. But on Monday night, he kind of had an open pit, as they say, in horseshoes. And so on Monday night, he didn't have the same restraint. And he preached a sermon. I mean, he just knocked it out of the park. It was the kind of thing where, you know, you just lost any sense of time. We got lost in it. It was such a good sermon. It was just spectacular. He could have gone on for an hour, and I don't think anyone would have complained. Because, you know, he preached well, and he gave us the expository information we needed but didn't give us any more. He gave us the instruction we needed but didn't give us any more. And above all, he preached Christ, and he preached a redemptive and reconciling God through it. And so what I think is what people would say they want is not the same as what their soul needs. And if their soul is fed, I'm not sure they'll complain then that they didn't get what they thought they wanted.
Right.
I mean, I'm sure a few will. And we just have to say that this is what we're about. I had a couple once in my church in New Hampshire complain about my preaching. And I went to see them, see what it was, to see if I could improve. And she said, well, your preaching is so philosophical. And I remember thinking about that, thinking, gosh, I don't think I've mentioned any Plato, and I haven't mentioned any Socrates. It's true that I read a little Heidegger and Gadamer when I was doing doctoral studies, but I didn't understand a word of it, so I know it didn't hurt me any. And I couldn't understand what this comment was. I was so philosophical. So I said, well, what do you mean when you say philosophical? And so her husband jumped in at that point and says, well, now, what she means is this. All of our other preachers we've ever had in the PCA just told us what to believe or do. You're always trying to prove to us from the scripture that we ought to believe it or do it. Right? And I said, oh, well, guilty as charged. I said, I can't change that. I'm committed to that. As a Protestant minister, I don't think I have any right or authority to tell you to do anything that isn't grounded in scripture. And so you're right. We may just have to part company. I can't help you.
As one who's coming from the newer generation that's going to be entering pulpits soon, or that's already out there, how do we go about being aware of our upbringing and trying to fix the problem? How do we go about remedying the reason that Johnny can't preach?
Well, the last chapter of my book is, you know, something like Johnny could learn to preach, as it were. And I go back to 1940 into the Stone Lectures at Princeton. And those lectures were published in 1941 by Charles Grosvenor Osgood as poetry as a means of grace. Now, in these lectures, he did not argue that poetry analogous to the word or prayer or sacrament was a technical means of grace. What he argued in the lectures at Princeton was that ministers who read verse would develop the sensibilities that will make them better preachers. Now, to help us think into a minute, he said this in 1940. This is 15 years before commercial television even appeared. And even in an already typographic culture, he was arguing that there was virtue to the reading of poetry that you wouldn't get from reading anything else. So imagine what that means for today, where we not only don't read poetry, we don't read. And so I think he's right. In my opinion, the sensibilities of composition, the sensibility of appropriate diction, and especially what I call the sensibility of significance, comes from dealing with media that deal with significance.
Mm-hmm.
And the poet, even if he's a pagan poet, right, he still deals with what is consequential. And television has nothing consequential on it, and on the rare occasion that it does, it treats the consequential inconsequentially. And so we live in an entire culture of Alfred E. Newman and David Letterman where no one takes anything seriously. But our religion is terribly serious.
Mm-hmm.
It's terribly serious. And the sensibility of the significant. The sensibility of the serious requires that an enormous amount of our conscious waking life is spent dealing with that which is consequential. And so I recommend reading a verse, the reading of novel, or listening to serious music that otherwise, as I say in the book, you go to seminary and it's like sending a dachshund to seminary and asking the homiletician to teach the dachshund to speak French. Just can't do it. The sensibilities just aren't there. I've heard the occasional sermon, for instance, on a text that was almost breathtaking just to hear it read. And thinking to myself, oh my goodness, what a stunning and significant, what a consequential text this is. And then some drivel about child rearing comes out of it, or how to be a good husband. And I just don't know how that can be until I realize, in a culture of the inconsequential, even when people read a consequential book like the Bible, they're tone deaf to its consequentiality. They just don't see it.
That's fascinating.
So are we able to help our congregations along as well by encouraging reading and steeping them in consequential things, trying to make them aware of that? Is that a possibility?
It is. What would happen would be, if people were under a steady diet of good preaching at least once a week, they would be confronted with the consequential, and it would alter their sensibilities. And so the tragedy in our day is many ministers are conforming their preaching to an inconsequential culture and therefore abdicating the one chance they had to be an alternative to it. But a steady diet of good preaching will alter people's sensibilities.
Dr. Gordon, do you think that that's true with regard to open-air preaching as well? Do you think there's still a place for open-air preaching in our society? You get just a diversity of opinion on this subject, and I'm interested to know what you think.
Yeah, I don't have a strong opinion on it. I mean, I guess that I feel like, you know, if it reaches the point in a culture where the mere doing of it appears to be kooky, and if no one will stop and actually listen to a discourse from the beginning to the end, then it's probably not a very useful thing to try. If, on the other hand, you find that you're doing the boardwalk preaching in New Jersey one summer and people stop and listen through an entire sermon, it seems like they're listening, then go ahead.
Right.
Now, Dr. Gordon, in terms of actual preaching, I remember when we interviewed Greg Reynolds, he said that I think he said that he did not use a manuscript in the pulpit, or am I?
No, I think he did, but he tried to write them in a way in which it didn't sound like written word. Was that the case?
Actually, I think Greg's practice is similar to mine. He has an outline.
He does have an outline. Okay, now, he did mention, I think it was Walter Ong, and the orality of preaching.
That's correct.
Can you get it how that what that means, as opposed to standing up there and reading, or even preaching a manuscript, which is more written in the vein of a discourse to be read rather than a sermon to be proclaimed?
Yeah, the element of truth, and by the way, this doesn't mean that all ministers should follow this. Some people may not be capable of doing it, and they're stuck with a manuscript, and they just have to make the most of it. But the element of truth is that there's an earnestness to the appeal when a minister looks people in the eye and tells them on behalf of God what is expected of them and what is offered to them in Christ. And when the eye is diverted to the manuscript, as though the minister's soul is wrapped up in the manuscript rather than his hearers, then you've lost something substantial. Now, that doesn't mean that, you know, and Edwards can't pull it off. But Edwards pulled it off in part because his was a highly literate culture and probably had a higher tolerance. But I think a person who has a good command of language will be able to wing it in terms of the actual sentences and paragraphs and can work from a manuscript or from an outline. But, see, that's because I'm assuming the kind of sensibilities cultivated, as Charles Grosvenor Osgood talked about, through being familiar with strong poets. If you're reading Dante, Spenser, Milton, Johnson, Frost, then when you're talking with people, even in conversation, the idiom available to you is very different than that available to others.
Well, can you? Would it be possible to provide a recommended list of poets to read, because I'm not, speaking for myself, I'm generally not a reader of poetry, but I should be. And if I may say, I never come away from hearing you that I'm fascinated by not only what you say, but the effectiveness with which you say it. And I'm not trying to butter you up. I'm just saying that this is the fact of my own reaction to when I hear you speak, lecture, preach. It's never boring.
Well, Greg says on the back of the book, and he blurred the book for me. It was a nice thing for Greg to do. And he said he, myself, brings two very important perspectives to bear, finely tuned literary sensibilities and media ecology. So Greg thinks that as well, that if one does read verse for a substantial part of one's life, it does have some influence on one's use of vocabulary. And I think novel can do it secondarily, by the way. I think part of it's just being around people who use the language in a manner in which its oral properties are important. That's why I especially think poetry is important, because poetry has a sound to it that's critical to its meaning. And so a good poet is very interested in the cadences and the rhythms and other properties of the oral quality of language, all of which shape you in your own use of language. So you can really get any anthology. The only thing I warn people is, you know, after World War II, and especially after the 1960s, poetry is so oblique that it's no longer universally accessible as it was prior to that. And you might frustrate yourself if you read anything much beyond Robert Frost. So I tend to recommend that people get good anthologies of English verse and just learn to read it. And it's hard. I can remember when I started doing it that a page of English verse was probably harder for me than a page from the Greek New Testament. Now, that's partly because my Greek was pretty good, but it was also because I didn't know what to look for when I was reading poetry.
Dr. Gordon, are there any living preachers that you would recommend our listeners listen to that you find to be very effective consistently in their preaching?
Well, there's just tons of people out there. It's just that, you know, I don't know them all. I don't want to sound like I'm omitting them. So, I mean, for me, sure. It's just the ones that I've bumped into. Greg Reynolds, of course, is a fine preacher. Tim Keller is a good preacher. John Yinchko is a good preacher. Lig Duncan's a good preacher. Brian Chappell was here earlier this year. Brian's a fine preacher. So there's just a whole bunch of them out there, actually.
Right.
And each of them that I just mentioned, for instance, each has his own style. I mean, you know, only Tim can preach the way Tim does. The rest of us, people would fall asleep if we spoke the way Tim did. Somehow Tim pulls it off.
Right.
There are many people out there who have a fine sense of language well employed. Their sentences have the kind of variety, the kind of pause, the kind of emphasis, where the manner in which they're speaking makes what they're speaking so much clearer.
Mm.
And most of those people at some point have been pretty astute readers of literature and probably verse, or they grew up in a family in which their parents were so influenced, and therefore the language that they learned from their mother's breast, as it were, had those refined sensibilities to it. But if you were to read poets, what would happen is the mind then puts together in one place all of the input of all the language you've ever been exposed to. So it's not that if you read Shakespeare, you'd start preaching in 14-line sonnets. That doesn't happen. And if you read Spencer, you wouldn't come out with a fairy queen from the pulpit. The point would be that all of these people together actually cultivate your own voice.
Yeah.
And
right.
Just the way a symphonist, the great symphonists, always were students of previous composers, and yet in the process developed their own voice.
Right.
And so preachers will do the same thing. Now, by contrast, to give you an example of the contrast, I was reading a collection of essays in a religious book several years ago. And one of the authors, his sentences sounded like this. Let's assume we could kind of blanket out like the Charlie Brown adults. His sentences sounded like this. Da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da And could, you know, it was just the same monotonous cadence every single sentence. And I thought, he's going to kill people with the Chinese water torture.
Kill me with cadence.
Yeah, and I'm thinking, for crying out loud, if this man preaches this way, he's going to have all sorts of comatose people out there. And I thought, this is probably a person who was trained in engineering or something like that and has never read literature for the sheer beauty of a thing well said. And so he just doesn't have the sensibilities to preach.
I wonder if some of what you've been talking about is not really exemplified in men like Sinclair Ferguson and Eric Alexander. I prefer to listen to a lot of the British men, Ian Hamilton, and I think some of that probably has to do with the education that they received in their schools, because they had a much better literary background than many Americans, I suspect, than I had. So I do think there's probably a lot of validity to what you're saying in this.
Yeah, and if you take two that are closer to home on this side of the Atlantic, when Jim Boyce was graduating from the Stony Brook School,
yes.
Frank Gabelein was the headmaster at the time, and Jim was heading off to Harvard University and then planning to enter Div School afterwards. And Gabelein told Frank, or Jim, he said, now listen here, don't you major in religion. You major in English literature and then study your theology when you get out. Mm. And so Jim, of course, had his distinctive career. And afterwards, when Phil Ryken replaced him and the church continued to prosper and do well, people would say to me, how could anyone replace Jim Boyce? And I said, Phil Ryken is Jim Boyce. His yes. father was the chair of the Department of English Literature at Wheaton College for 35 years. Mm. He's just Jim with yeah. a different name and a different set of fingerprints. He has the same literary sensibilities that Jim had. And both of them knew how to read a text and find what was there, not read into the text what wasn't. Both of them knew how to speak. And so even on this side, the Americans who've had a strong literary background have more competent careers as expository preachers than those who didn't.
Yes.
Yeah. Hey, one last question here as we're winding down, just concerning, again, the media of PowerPoints. Some pastors use the PowerPoints to portray pictures, and certainly that would be, I think, altogether unhelpful, a way we don't want to go. But what about with reference to using PowerPoint during a sermon and putting text up there? What are your thoughts on that, either the biblical text or an outline of the sermon itself, if you could give some closing thoughts on in that regard?
Well, there's been a whole cottage industry since about 2007 of what I inelegantly call stupid studies. Different people who are writing books on how we have become so stupid so fast. And some of them are neurologists and some of them are educators and so forth. There's a whole host of people. But one of the things many people are concerned about now is multitasking. That the human neurology does its best work when it does a single thing.
What did you say? I was chatting somebody.
The human neurology.
I'm kidding.
Oh, yeah, sorry. You got distracted there. Yeah. You never know on telephone whether someone is in their office, you know. And so, you know, I tend not to encourage distraction and multitasking because having read these books, now I feel a little irresponsible if I'm the source of it. So I certainly don't think it's a necessity, and I think that it would be to the advantage of everyone living in this highly distracted culture to learn to focus. I'm not sure I'd want to be the one to provide the occasion for the distraction. So you might have, some of you are familiar with Maggie Jackson's book that came out in 2008, Distracted, The Coming Dark Age. She's a journalist up with the Boston Globe, and she's dealt with the question that we are just highly, highly distracted and multitasking.
Absolutely.
And, I think people get to the point where psychologically they live in such a state to the point that they're uncomfortable, quiet with silence and concentration.
Yes, yes.
And at that point, last thing we want to do is contribute to that state.
Mm-hmm.
Do the rules change if we're talking about teaching, Dr. Gordon, as opposed to preaching with reference to using media?
Yeah, I think so, because remember that teaching is much more of a dialogue and preaching much more of a monologue,
mm-hmm.
the ordinary yes. sense. Mm-hmm. So if I'm teaching a class, I have a lecture outline up behind me on the screen here at Grove City College. The students have a copy of it that they got on the network if they wanted to before they came in. And then I walk around the room and we chat with them about the significance of these ideas and try to make sense of them. Then they can pose questions at any time. And so a dialogue is a very different thing, it seems to me, than a monologue.
Would it be fair to say we should propose something like a regulative principle of media in the worship service?
Well, if you're persuaded as I am of the exegesis of some of the pertinent passages, it comes out that way anyway.
Mm-hmm.
That is to say, when Paul says God has chosen through the foolishness of preaching to save those who believe, or Romans 10, as one of you alluded to earlier, how can they believe if no one preaches and so forth, if they don't
preach?
Right. Then I think there's a sufficient case to be made there that God has chosen the media of the proclaimed word as the ordinary means by which he convicts and rescues lost sinners.
Amen. This has been a great discussion. We're just about out of time. Dr. Gordon has to get going in a few minutes to go teach a class. We wish he could tag along with you, but we'll have to wait until next time. So it's been great to have you on, T. David. Thanks for joining us.
Thank you for having me.
You can pick up his book, Why Johnny Can't Preach. It's available from PNR Publishing. Westminster Bookstore has a great price on it, just $5.99. So you can go to the website and pick that book up. I also want to, of course, mention our website, reformedforum.org. You can find links to all of our other sites. We're definitely growing in terms of a network, and there's several things out there, including oldlife.org and feedingonchrist.com. So just visit the website, and it'll point you on to everything you need to get. We want to thank everybody for listening, and we look forward to having you back next time on Christ the Center.